You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Welcome back to Earth Station Trek, a show where we trek from the early days on NBC to the future on Paramount Plus and everywhere in between. I'm Charles Kelso, and it's my pleasure to introduce the Earth Station Trek crew, Keith Johnson.
Heidi-ho!
Alan Seiler.
What's up?
And Veronica Daschle.
Hi!
And this is the first podcast we've recorded as we're part of the ESO Podcast Network.
We
spent our first several episodes searching for the hidden ESO headquarters. We finally found them. And Admiral Faber has welcomed us into the fleet. So anyone out there who's joining us from off the ESO Podcast Network, welcome to the show. I hope you check out our previous episodes. I wanted to mention as well, we've got a little bit of feedback on an episode that was just released. A friend of the show, Vandy Beth Glenn, commented on our Facebook group to let us know that I made a mistake. I conflated Alan Napier with Charles Napier. Alan Napier, of course, played Alfred on the original Batman series in the 60s, and Charles Napier played Adam, the space hippie. And she's absolutely right. I noticed that as well when I was editing the episode. One of the most difficult things editing the episode is not going back and correcting my own mistakes. So fortunately, we've got listeners out there who are paying attention. So, you know, if you're listening to this show and you have something you'd like to add, join our Facebook group. You can hit us on Twitter or you can email us at earthstationtrek@gmail.com. Let us know if I say something stupid or if you have an episode suggestion that Veronica's not seen, let us know. We're happy to get any kind of feedback.
Charles, wait till we do a live show and you see a feed scrolling across when they correct this in real time.
That's right. I thought about inserting the TOS computer saying incorrect every time I hear myself say something wrong.
Yes.
I love it.
That'd be awesome.
So a little bit of news. As we're recording this, it's February the 18th. It'll go out in another couple of weeks, but wanted to stop and mention the fact that two Star Trek series started filming today. The first season of Strange New Worlds and the second season of Star Trek Picard.
Woohoo! That's exciting.
Pretty exciting. Yeah. Exciting time to be a Star Trek fan. So Discovery's still filming. Now we've got, you know, Strange New Worlds, Picard have joined in on filming. We've still got Lower Decks and Prodigy that are in production. That's five series right now that are actively producing episodes today.
Isn't that incredible?
That is amazing. That is
absolutely amazing.
In the 90s, in the late 90s, just having two was pretty awesome. And right now we have five.
Yeah, isn't that incredible? When you would have, you thought it was like, you know, when DS9 and Voyager overlapped and then Enterprise came along and, you know, TNG was going at the same time that DS9 was starting. You thought, oh my God, is this going to be too much? Is it going to be franchise burnout or something? And now we've got five series in production. I'm so excited. Plus, there may be some new Short Treks in production too that we don't even know about.
Yeah,
it could be.
So let's just count it as six.
Yes.
I've heard people mentioning that they're afraid of that franchise fatigue, but yeah, I think with the shows aren't airing at the same time. They're not airing the same week. They're not airing the same night. You don't have to choose one. You know, they're staggering these over the course of a year. So I think if they could do five CSI shows at a time, then we can get, you know, five Star Trek shows staggered across the year.
Heck absolutely. Yeah. Star Trek 365.
I agree. You know, they're different in a lot of ways. You've got a cartoon. You've got other things.
Yes.
So I think that helps the variety, I think.
That's exactly what I was going to say, is that I was watching something last night and like Jeopardy. And it's like coming up tonight, Chicago Fire, Chicago PD, Chicago, yes, whatever the other thing is, Chicago Med.
Yeah.
And I'm like, how much? Sorry. I was like, God, how much stuff goes on in Chicago? You know, and they're all kind of the same show, at least for Star Trek. It's all these different productions are all happening at a different point in the Trek history. They're different styles of delivery. It's just amazing. It's such a great time to be a fan.
I think so too.
Absolutely.
That.
Yeah, as long as they don't start doing procedural shows with Star Trek, I think that is where Chuck might fall off.
Oh, I don't know. I think you could have a Star Trek JAG office drama kind of like that. Absolutely.
Yeah, I remember back when Voyager was on UPN, and very briefly they had a show called Mercy Point that was a hospital in space.
Yes.
And
yes.
I forget the actor's name now, the guy from T2 who played Miles Dyson. I think he was like the main doctor on it. I think if I'm remembering correctly, now I was probably 15 at the time, but if I'm remembering correctly, he was the main guy, and it was like a Star Trek hospital, not Star Trek, but like a space hospital show.
Yeah, yeah. I remember that.
I could go for something like that.
Absolutely.
I'm not usually a fan of procedurals, but there's not usually aliens in them. So
that's a very good point.
Now, some other news that came out this week is the return of the outrageous O'Connor.
Now that is unexpected.
It is. It is.
Just wacko.
You're not a fan of the outrageous O'Connor.
Like the actor, hated that episode.
Yeah, I wasn't. The episode itself wasn't great. I thought when I saw it that he was going to be kind of like a Harry Mudd for Next Gen. He just never came back.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I thought too.
But it actually gives us a little bit of hints about Star Trek Prodigy. If O'Connor's in it, assuming he's not a hologram or 150 years old, it sort of gives us a general time frame of Prodigy, sort of TNG to post TNG time frame. If O'Connor's around.
Well, it stars Kate Mulgrew, so it's post Voyager, definitely.
Yeah, it stars her, but I've been wondering. See, I sort of was suspecting that it was going to be like a later, like a Voyager A or something, and you'd have like a Janeway hologram. I'm trying to figure out how Janeway can be like a regular on the show. So we know that the show is what they've said is that it's a group of teens that find a derelict starship. So my thought was maybe there's an emergency command hologram or something, and then you have a Janeway popping up. But
that's possible.
It is. But now with O'Connor in the mix, it makes me think that maybe we're getting real Janeway. Maybe it's sort of not too long after the TNG to Voyager timeframe.
Yeah, I think she's either going to be an ambassador or she's an instructor at Starfleet Academy.
Yeah, that could be interesting.
Yeah, I think so, too. I'm really excited about it. I go to the Gallifrey One convention in LA every February, except this one, for the biggest Doctor Who convention in the world. And two of the guests that were there are the lead writers on Prodigy. They were there last year and they were talking about it, and they couldn't say anything because nothing had been announced. So they didn't say anything about cast. They didn't say the title, but they talked at length about their approach to guiding a new Star Trek show. And it was really fascinating to hear. And I'm really looking forward to seeing what they've done with it. And it just sounded so much like they really get Trek, like they're old school Trekkers and they know the game. So yeah. I'm excited to see what happens.
That's what we're getting a lot of now is the old school Trekkers. They're like, yeah, TNG was my thing. And now I'm going to make Star Trek.
Exactly.
That's funny because I'm a Trekkie and OS was my thing.
It's interesting, though, now that we're getting a lot of people making Star Trek who are inspired by the Next Gen era, where the guys who were making that were inspired by the original series. So it's nice now that we're sort of in the future beyond Next Gen, where they can reference back and sort of build upon the things that were in the Next Gen time frame.
Exactly.
And just wait, 25, 30 years from now, Star Trek will still be cranking along, and the people making it are the ones who started their Trek journey with Discovery or Picard or Lower Decks. And that's an exciting prospect.
Yeah, absolutely. We were doing a library show a year or two ago. And, you know, we always have our Spock puppet up on display, and a family came by and the mom said to the daughter, "Oh, look, you know him. That's Michael's brother." And that was the first time someone had ever saw my Spock puppet and identified it as Michael's brother. So it's
wow.
That sort of gave me pause that, like, wow, there is a new generation who, you know, for whom, you know, Spock isn't the main character. He's related to Michael Burnham. You know what I mean? That's their own Star Trek heroes.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
Okay, guys, we're interjecting a little bit of a message from the future here. Like we said earlier, we recorded this episode a few weeks ago, but we didn't want to wait on the fact that they've announced the writer of the next Star Trek movie, Kalinda Vasquez.
Mm-hmm.
Is anybody familiar with Kalinda Vasquez?
Not at all.
I wasn't. I heard her. I didn't know anything about it other than a couple of years ago. I'd heard an anecdote about her name because she's named for Kalinda from what is it? I should know that because I love that the first half of that episode. By
any other name. I love the first half of that episode.
Yeah, yeah. Another podcast idea. Episodes that really fell off.
There you go.
Yeah, that's all I really knew about her. And I'm cautiously excited because I'm getting whiplash between everybody from Quentin Tarantino to take your pick writing for Star Trek. I hope this is real and goes to something. I don't know enough about her to really have a feeling one way or the other. I just hope they stick with somebody and see it all the way through.
Right. Yeah, that's the only thing really that's sort of keeping me from getting excited about it is this is the fourth time now, I think, that we've been through this. Mm-hmm. What's coming for the next Star Trek movie after Beyond?
Four times, huh?
Yeah, yeah. So it's like, okay, we'll see.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, this is somebody that's already in house.
Right.
You know, she wrote two episodes last year on Discovery, mm-hmm. both of which were great episodes.
Yep. Good point.
She's done some production stuff on Discovery as well. So she's a known quantity as far as like the production staff goes. So I don't know. I feel a little more secure about this one than I have some of the previous announcements.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's encouraging too that if they start pulling people from the TV side.
Exactly.
It seems like where Star Trek has had success in the films before was going through the TV department, keeping the budgets down.
Right.
You know, going with their folks. And like Keith said, it's exciting that she's named after a Star Trek character because that's just cool.
It's in her blood, man.
Right. Yes. Yeah, it for sure has been around since she was a kid. So it's not like she just heard about Star Trek and Googled it, you know?
Right.
I think you make a really, really good point. You know, as you know, this is one of the ongoing discussions and debates. Is Star Trek a franchise for the television screen or is it a franchise for the movies? Mm-hmm. And, you know, as great as some of the writing has been, I hate to be that guy, but in some ways, some of the best writing Star Trek ever had, never surpassed, was from the 60s. And that's because everybody involved with that series was a great television writer, a great dramatic television writer. You think about it, they had so many guys from the original series who were writing for, and women, who were writing for Twilight Zone, Outer Limits, Robert Block, you know, famous for the concept of the old ones, horror stories. Mm-hmm. And I think having a TV background, I agree with you 100%, it helps. I think it'll help write a good story. I see so many times, sometimes with Star Trek and other TV properties, when they try to do a movie, you can tell it's like they took the TV show and like they just stretched it for a movie.
Yeah.
It doesn't really feel like a movie. It feels padded. And sometimes you could almost see them going, hey, we can't do this R-rated or adult thing on the television screen. Let's just take it to another level on the movie. And it kind of, you know, it shows up.
Yeah.
You can tell.
Yeah,
so I think it's a great point you guys are making about her having television writing experience.
Yeah, and I wish they would do more. I mean, they're doing movie quality stuff on the TV shows now.
Absolutely.
You know, it's not like the old days where the TV had two sets. I mean, you look at the premiere, for instance, of Star Trek Discovery or the most recent season of Discovery. I mean, it's movie level epic. I think the 2-hour premiere of Discovery is probably more epic in scope than most Star Trek movies that have been made up to this point.
Okay.
I mean, they're filming overseas. They've got the big Klingon battles. You know, you're not seeing reused footage of a bird of prey exploding,
right?
You know, like
exactly.
We've seen in Star Trek movies before. But I wish they would get the budget down, do kind of like the way Universal changed course after their big budget Mummy movie didn't do so hot. They made an $11 million Invisible Man movie that made almost as much money as the other one did, you know? Now, mm-hmm. you probably couldn't do it for $11 million, but I don't know what the premiere budget of Discovery was, but it wasn't $250 million or $500 million or like big budget movie money that they're spending on that. But they're getting that look, though.
Yeah,
without a doubt.
But another exciting element of this is if this movie gets made, she would be the first female film screenwriter for Star Trek.
Yeah, that is exciting.
So what about way back when Deesa Fontana was still alive? Did she just collaborate but didn't get full screenwriter?
That wasn't on the movies, though. She was on TV. So there have been plenty of writers for TV that were women, but the movies are just dudes.
I honestly didn't know that. I would have thought with people like Deesa Fontana and others around, they had at least shared screenwriting credit all these years.
No, yeah, the movies has just been written by guys. So it's exciting, too, because,
I don't want to get into this conversation because it'll derail the whole thing, but I like the Kelvin movies. Let me just say that, but they get pretty bro-y. So I wouldn't mind, you know, having a female perspective on this universe and into the films, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that would be cool.
We're going to take a little bit of a break now to promote some of our fellow ESO Network podcast shows. And then we'll be back with this week's discussion topic. So, you know, as they say, after these messages, we'll be right back.
The 42 cast is turning 100, but like all good things, it must come to an end. Tune in to our epic finale as we see who lives, who dies, and who gets their own spinoff. And then come back when the 42 cast is back for season 2, with even more segments, more guests, and more of explaining why Ryan is wrong. It's why we're still the ultimate answer to fandom, geekiness, and everything. You can only find all this awesome by downloading the 42 cast, a proud member of the ESO Network.
Hey everyone, this is George Tripsis, co-host from the Metal Geeks podcast, along with Carrie the Metal Geek and Brutal Dave. Our show is where we bring the metal geek culture and heavy metal culture and mash it into the geek culture. Come listen to our show where we talk about movies, comic books, Disney stuff, and mostly about movies where I'm always right and Carrie's never right. Check us out at metalgeeks.net. You can catch us on all your ear hole listening podcast devices.
I'm Carrie the Metal Geek, and I approve this message.
So moving on to our discussion topic, and Keith, you've been banging the drum for this one. So we're going to be talking about the Star Trek Voyager two-parter Equinox. And Keith, why are you so hot to talk about Equinox?
I've been on a Voyager rewatch in the last year or so, and Voyager has always been my least favorite of all the Star Trek series. Now, that doesn't mean I don't like it. That's like saying if Deep Space Nine is a 9.5, Voyager was an 8.3. Mm. So I've always, you know, I like so specific.
Yeah.
I like all the shows, but I'm watching Voyager. And one of the things definitely, and something I want to talk about one time in the future, is how your opinion of Star Trek characters and stories and series change as you get older. Mm. And there are things that mean more to me now watching Voyager at this age and what's going on in my life than when it first came out. So as I'm watching Voyager, I'm seeing a lot more of the characterizations and I'm liking the people more. And Equinox, when you look at Equinox, a good science fiction show has some elements that make it work. One, of course, it has a good sci-fi hook. It has a good sci-fi angle, which this has with the aliens coming from another dimension and their neurogenic energy being used for warp drive. But a good science fiction show, to be complete, has more than just the science fiction. It has good characterizations where you can relate to these people. And here you're talking about Ransom and his crew, who those Starfleet officers, they're desperate. They're lonely. They're literally dying. He mentioned the Janeway. They hadn't eaten for 16 days when they first came across these aliens. And so you have the human element, the dramatic element with which you can relate. And then you have the cultural elements and the examination of something in universe, such as the Prime Directive. Does it always apply? Does it ever not apply? And they really hit that really hard. And then just to round it out, it's just a rollicking, good, action-packed show. I watched it again today, and it is really well directed. It's got camera work that's impressive. It's got moments where the crew stand together and talk that are just really good, dramatic. It's really just one of the best produced and directed and shot and acted episodes of Voyager I've ever seen. And it just hit every button for me: science fiction, drama, acting, action. It was just it's a great show. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, it really is. And it gives Janeway a nice dilemma as well. Not even one that she has to debate, but sort of the responsibility of upholding the Starfleet values. Right. Something that, you know, Kirk had to face when Ron Tracy came across Ron Tracy.
Yes.
Yeah. So and Kirk had to sort of stand up for the Starfleet ideals. You know, Sisko had that with Eddington. You know, sort of something that Starfleet officers that have to face from time to time is, you know, you're out on the frontier. Another Starfleet captain has broken their oath, and it's up to you to stand up for it, you know?
Right.
What I find so incredibly interesting, there's a number of things that I find really interesting about this story, but the one that I find really, really a brave choice is that the whole story is about it's a contrast between Voyager's journey and another ship that had the exact same experience happen, but their trail goes a completely different way. Their ship is in disrepair and their crew is in dire straits and they haven't eaten and they've lost power and they're just horrible. And they take these actions, these drastic actions that they would never take in any other circumstance, but they're driven to this sort of like choice because of their horrible circumstances that they're in. And coming face to face with that, Janeway starts to go the same path. She makes choices that she might not otherwise make, driven by her anger at these people, her lack of understanding of what they're going through. And now, you know, they're torturing and killing an alien species. And obviously that's wrong and you have to deal with it. But she takes actions and goes to lengths that her crew starts to call her out on. And yeah. I find that journey is so easy to slip into the dark path.
And specifically Chakotay, and we were just talking recently on our 7 of 9 episode about how Chakotay had a little more fire in his belly earlier in the series. But here we are. Well, this is the end of season 5, beginning of season 6.
Yeah.
And Chakotay is, you know, he's standing right up to Janeway.
Yeah, exactly.
To the point where she relieves him of duty.
Right. And Chakotay is, to me, the blandest character on the show. And I really love it when he finds a backbone, basically. And this same sort of thing happened 2 seasons earlier in Scorpion, where Janeway is put out of action and he has to take command of the mission. And he and she are at odds about what to do. He goes along with her as long as she's in charge. Once she's out of the role and he takes command, he backtracks on everything that she's done. This time, they just have to go head to head and they like battering rams. And it's so interesting.
I agree with that completely. Veronica, what did you think about the episode? Or what was your overall feelings and thoughts from it? Because I think Alan summed up really well what hit home for him.
Yeah, I was kind of surprised at how ununderstanding Janeway was about what they had to do to survive. Mm-hmm. Because at some point, survival instinct's going to kick in. And I understand why she was upset. I would be upset too. That's not the right thing to do. But at the same time, there was a line that they crossed and there wasn't any gray area for her. But I feel like there was gray area in other episodes where she kind of bent it that I probably definitely did not go that far. But I feel like she stretched it a little bit more. And this episode, when she's trying to hold it so hard, it just seemed, it almost seemed out of character to me.
Well, it's sort of like, it's on the one hand, it's you're doing this thing to these aliens that is purely wrong. But the other side of it is you're taking actions that my crew could easily have taken and we didn't. And she's furious at them for going the easy route.
Yeah. Go ahead.
No,
I was going to say, you could argue that, you know, when Janeway was willing to give the Borg the ability to assimilate species 8472. In exchange for their safety and getting home, that would be, you know, that would be a worse crime than murdering, say, 60 aliens.
Yeah. You know? I mean, yeah, if you're going to count numbers, yes, that would be.
A question I have, Veronica, had you seen this before?
I feel like I had seen it before, but I don't hold episodes in my brain very well at all.
Because the reason, because I wonder, because you said you were surprised. So I'm wondering, because I think I know Charles and Alan and I, we knew everything that was coming. So I wonder for you, how did that feel to see her? And also, if you have been watching, you know, Voyager recently, like I have, to your point, was that how shocking was that to you to either see a captain like Janeway go the route she went and another Starfleet? And also, Charles, I got to make a shout out to Return of the Crazy Captain, which I've missed. and a captain like Ransom to do what he did, because my gosh, he went pretty far. So was that shocking to you?
Yeah, a little bit. I feel like that once they realized what it could do, they should have maybe gone back to those people and see if they knew anything about it and what might they could have helped them with. But I don't know, because I always jumped around to various episodes. I attempted to watch straight through season one and I did not make it halfway. Mm-hmm. So I've watched bits and pieces of Voyager over the last 10 years. And so what I watch now, maybe something I watched at least once 5 years ago, but now it's a new episode to me because I don't hold episodes in my brain at all.
Well, that's kind of cool.
Well, that's nice because then Star Trek is always new for you.
Yes.
And you make a point I hadn't really thought about, which is funny, which was one thing I thought was really interesting and I thought was kind of tragic was how incredibly generous that race was, because how many races introduce you to their gods like that so quickly, or their spirits of good fortune. And then being so innocent, they gave them a summoning device, which I don't know if everybody would have done. You know, I don't know if everybody would have given some strangers a device to summon their angels or their gods or their good luck spirits. And to your point, they turned on them. And it's funny, I've watched that show so many times. It never occurred to me that them could have done something as simple as said, is there any way you can help us? Because they're naturally neurogenic creatures and they travel through interdimensional space. They never even thought for once to ask them, could they help them? Which is interesting because that never crossed my mind.
That's a good point.
Well, I wonder if that's what they were doing when they initially trapped that one, is they were going to try and communicate with it, but it couldn't survive there. And they tried to send it back, but they couldn't send it back. So I watched the first part earlier today and I'm already not remembering what happened in that particular scene.
Wow.
Yeah.
But I remember the scene. Well, I don't remember the specifics.
You know what I find interesting about that? It's that, thank what you guys are just saying, it's taking one step, you know, because if you think about it, my first thought was, would Picard have let his crew capture a being that could have been sentient, even to study it like that, straight off? Because even though, like you said, they didn't mean to hurt it, but would Picard have done that? Would a creature that you already think might be sentient, would Picard have said, hey, Geordi and Data, build me a trap so we can trap it and study it? I kind of think he wouldn't even have done that.
He would have made a different way to communicate with it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, totally.
Because totally. Then when it died, Ransom looked, he was genuinely upset. He said, beam it back. And then it died. And then the question is, would Picard or Kirk or Sisko or Archer have then used the remains of a dead sentient being they just killed for their own gain? Because when he was talking to Janeway, he kind of said, it was already dead. What would you do?
Yeah.
My gosh.
Yeah.
And at the same time, you know, Ransom's on a ship. Half the crew's dead. He's got 40 people left alive on a small science vessel. Can barely do warp 8, limited weapons on the far side of the galaxy, and they're starving. You know, the level of desperation, you know, that how far they are from home and what limited resources they have, you know, and all of a sudden it just drops in their lap, this dead creature that can jump them across space. And I definitely see how they could have gone down that slippery slope.
Yeah.
You know, it's a different universe when you're on the Federation flagship in the heart of the Federation. You know, as opposed to, you know, he's responsible for getting these people home. And they even sort of hammered in just how close that crew had gotten, that they're all on first name basis now, you know, and he said when they first set off to head for home, they reminded everyone we're explorers and we're going to broaden our knowledge of the universe. Pretty soon we forgot we were human.
Yeah.
You know?
Yes. And it's almost two different decisions. The one is they captured the alien. They couldn't return it. It died. They discovered this property and they used the dead creature to give them a jump.
Right.
Second one is to repeat that process.
Exactly. Yeah.
And it's the repeat. I mean, the first one was an accident. It wasn't planned. It was a discovery that they made in a terrible, tragic situation.
Mm-hmm.
But the real crime is in repeating that process to get that result. Over and over and over.
Exactly. Because to you guys' point, you know, I know we all probably land, but I'm sitting here on my couch watching that and eating. And I'm from Texas and I have, so bad, you know, I'm from Texas and I have a lot of friends and family back home in Texas as we record this, who have no power. One of my brothers just got power for the first time in 3 days in his house. It was in the 40s. And like they say, it's easy to say these things when you have a full belly. But of course, I'm sitting here saying, I'd never do that. You know, I keep telling myself that. I'm like, I'd never capture a sentient being. And then I would tell myself, even if it died accidentally, I would never have used its body. I would have just said, we can't do this. But then to your point, Alan, if I had done those first two, now the next step is, oh, let's call another one. And you just keep going and you keep going. And then,
well, here's the thing. If you're lost in the woods, mm-hmm. or, you know, in a snowy mountain or something, and you are going to die, are you not going to kill and eat a rabbit?
Well, here's an interesting question. A rabbit, yeah, but a
I know. Exactly.
And that's right. A good point, that they convinced themselves that they were monsters or just creatures and not.
Exactly right.
Because it's
that's exactly what I'm thinking.
Yeah.
So, but at what point did they decide they were sentient beings? Because
that's the thing. Yes, that's the thing I'm saying.
Memory is they never communicated even with the people that they got the summoner from. They thought they were gods because they couldn't communicate with them and they floated around. So
yeah, how did they know that they weren't just like space trout or something?
Yeah.
Good point. Well, what do you think about that, Charles? I kept asking that question too, because sometimes it's how things act. It's kind of like in the classic OS series Obsession with the cloud creature. I remember one of the things was everybody kept telling Kirk that creature wasn't sentient. And then Spock says that it showed strategy when it led the Enterprise on a long chase. It turned around and attacked, and Spock said that was indicative of sentience. So I'm kind of wondering, at all during those times, did they not get an idea that those creatures might have been sentient?
I'm sure they did. Yeah,
it made me think also of The Devil in the Dark, where you have the monster at the beginning, and then you discover the monster is actually self-defense. Right. You know, that the humans are the monsters.
Right.
From your perspective. So we're hitting a couple of original series tropes in this episode. And I think using them to good effect. I thought that the aliens were pretty neat for as far as 90s CGI aliens go. You know, they weren't 8472 level, but they're pretty cool. But yeah, we never and I think it's smart that they never just start speaking to us. You know, we never find out that they have a culture and they have the elder ones and we've been murdering their children. You know, it's that they leave that a bit ambiguous, but
well, at the end, don't they bring the guy back from the original planet and he's like communicating with them and he's telling them what they're saying? I just remember that.
Yeah, and
I remember something. Yeah,
right. And a kind of a really strangely weird thing that's a little bit hilarious is they're in the cargo bay or whatever, and Janeway goes, "Can it understand me?" And then goes, "Yeah." So they understand English. And so also it made me wonder that Ransom and them never just try to talk to them. But I guess by then they were too busy killing them because they literally do it, which I thought was interesting. So let me ask a question. What did y'all think about one reason that I like the show is I'm real sensitive to things like music and sound. And I don't know how many of you are familiar with Babylon 5, but you know, every time you have some science fiction discussions, there are always these things like what's the best music and what's the sound that gets you more. And for me, sounds in science fiction that always evoke a reaction are the Tyrannosaurus Rex in the Jurassic Park, the original sound of Godzilla. And for me, Babylon 5, if you're familiar with, it's the sound of the shadows screeching through space.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That gets me to this day. I don't know what it is about that, but that sound, it evokes a mood. And one of the things that gets me about Equinox is that opening scene where you're thrown in, and Veronica, that must be wild for you. You're thrown in and there's a Federation ship and you hear that horrible screeching, whining sound. And then there's an attack and you're like, holy moly, this is going to be an interesting show.
And I really like that the sound effect comes before the thing happens.
Yeah.
So it sets up that sort of like, that tension, that anticipation.
Right.
It's almost Hitchcockian.
Yeah.
You know, where he like will hint to the audience that something is about to happen before the thing happens. And I found that really, really a fun element of the story.
Yeah, and they use that to good effect when they're in the turbo lift.
Exactly.
Chakotay and what's her face. Of course, he's like, "Oh, that's just the so and so. It's never made that sound before." What are you?
Oh yeah,
like dude, I wrote that down. It always does that.
Yeah,
that was cool. No, it doesn't. I wrote that down. I'm like, you've never heard that random sound before. It was almost like a horror movie trope where they go, "What's that?" You know, when they look around.
Yeah.
I thought that was good, but I thought the actress who played her did a really good job because she had really big eyes and really expressive eyes, and I kind of felt for her. I felt for her because she was desperate. Like you said, their crew, he only had a crew of 80. And I froze frame a lot on this show and did like hand comparisons. Voyager's at least three times bigger than Equinox, just kind of eyeballing it. And they had a crew that was 2.5 times. And then, of course, size in this case probably doesn't matter because Voyager was built to be basically a quick strike ship and the Equinox was built to be a science vessel. So, I mean, Voyager's armed to the teeth for a ship that size. And to your point, I kind of felt from her name was Marla and for the crewman. But at the same time, a question I had, well, one of the things, one reason I like the show is there's that whole thing where literally they ended up saying, to a certain extent, I was just following orders. And that comes up so much time, so many times in Star Trek, when people say, you know, I was only following orders. There's even an episode where Picard even says the excuse I was only following orders has been used too much. And so while I felt for them, I've never served in the military, but I have friends and family who have. And I know that a soldier is empowered to disobey a command when it violates the morality of the service in which they're supposed to serve. So ideally, if your commanding officer tells you to kill a child, you say no, even if it's your commanding officer. And so it's a real struggle because you feel for those people. And then, like they said, they're loyal to their captain. When Janeway put the crewman in the cargo bay and threatened to kill, to make him talk, he says, no way in hell am I going to betray my captain. And Chakotay tells her in the hall, that's his captain. He's loyal to his captain. So they're loyal to their commander and the family they become. But then you keep thinking, but they still have a greater moral responsibility. And I like the scene where Ransom tells Janeway, I wrote it down. He says, he basically tells her to spare his crew. They were just following orders. And Janeway says with just cold anger, their mistake. And that was
Wow. There's a difference though between being ordered to kill a child and being ordered to kill a screeching space bat.
Especially if it's a screeching space bat that can get you home.
Yeah. I definitely see. I mean, it's a different ride on any starship, I think, if you're the captain or if you're an ensign, you know, but especially in this morally ambiguous situation where it's, I mean, I would think it's really easy to go, well, the captain said this is what we should do. You know, like who and what are you going to do if you disobey? They're going to throw
that's
you
what I was going to
stay in the Delta Quadrant.
Exactly. They're going to kick you off the boat or something. What are you going to do?
These 40 people are all the people you've got.
Yes, exactly. The thing that I found really interesting, though, is there was sort of a turning point in the middle of the story. And that's where Janeway and Ransom are talking and he's kind of probing her a little bit on. So have you ever broken the prime directive? Yes. And
love it.
You know, instead of their reaction to the situation being, oh, my gosh, a superior in technology, superior Federation ship has found us. We're saved. We are no longer going to starve. We have help. We can get home. Okay, we've done some bad things. We need to confess. We understand that we may have to ride the trip out in the brig, but at least we're going to get home and we're going to be safe. Instead, they double down on their crime.
Yeah.
Separate themselves from the Voyager crew, go rogue, and, you know, and continue on this criminal path that they're on. So what are they going to do when they get home?
Yeah, I was wondering that because if I'm remembering correctly, at the end, there's like still two or three of the crew standing and they put them in the brig and never hear about them again.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's a shame that we never saw any of those characters again. But I mean, you're doing this thing because you know that you're going to face criminal charges from Voyager and have to ride out the trip in those circumstances. But if you make it all the way home by yourself, you're going to still face criminal charges, but more severe.
Yeah.
So what was the point in them, you know?
Yeah, that's where it threw me off with the captain.
Because
he was so adamant about, no, we have to keep going. We're almost there.
Yeah,
but it's like, exactly. he even said, like, was it 64 more jumps?
Yeah.
They'd have to kill someone for it?
Yeah, I think, though, I mean, you get back to Federation space, ditch the ship, blow it up, and then make up whatever story you want.
Well, that's a good point.
I think return to
Earth in escape pods after your ship blows up.
Yeah, I can't believe we found that wormhole. We're back, guys.
And actually, Charles, you know? Make a good point. They've got to blow up the ship because all in that ship is the record of what they did. That modified engine. They would probably have some alien parts left around. They have to deactivate the doctor, the crazy doctor who they took his ethical subroutine offline. Yeah,
the crazy doctor.
I found the doctor pretty chilling in this.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Wow. What?
Yeah, I really enjoyed that. I love any time that Picardo gets a unique role and gets some focus, and he's just an amazing guy.
Right.
But I also really enjoyed the role that Seven played in this.
Yeah.
As a captive, as a, you know, resisting. Singer. Yeah, and that too.
It struck me how they just deleted the doctor's ethical, subroutine. And you think that, well, that's my friend. You know, he's not going to hurt me. And then it's like, doop, doop, we just deleted his ethics. And it's like, okay, great.
Yeah. It's interesting that it can happen that quickly.
Yeah.
Flip of a switch. It's just like Data's off switch on his back.
Right. Yeah. You know? I was a little disappointed, though, that all it takes is a good smack to turn that 29th century mobile emitter off.
Right.
You know, I would put some padding around that thing or something.
You know what? I really one day want to do a show where we talk about things like that or that are kind of goofy, because to your point, that mobile emitter can float. It can levitate. It can generate a force field. And yet, for some reason, it can't generate a force field on a hologram to cover itself. As in, it should be inside the doctor's quote-unquote body, but for some reason, it can only appear to be on the outside. And to your point, he basically took the equivalent of a clipboard and goes, bam, and it turned him off. And I laughed every time I saw that scene. I thought that was hilarious.
It did get you right to the bits, though, where he's impersonating the doctor, which...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I loved everything that Picardo had to do in this one. I really like that character, and I like when they let him go down a little evil path.
Exactly.
Yeah, he was chilling. Alan, you made a point about, and I think Veronica, you made a point about they could have talked to the creatures, and Alan, you made a point about how they were just going to abandon them, and Charles, you made a point about how they weren't considering the sentience of these creatures. At any point in what they did, I will tell you that the two things that really chilled me more, three things chilled me in the show that really bothered me. It was when Ransom and them took off and they basically said, they'll be okay. They got weapons and food. Let's get out of here. The other thing that really troubled me was when Ransom went in there and saw the doctor basically torturing Seven, and the doctor told him her higher brain functions might be disrupted, and Ransom let it go on. And then when Max told B'Elanna, she said, Max, people are dying over here. And he just goes, well, I'm sorry, you have to be one of them.
Exactly.
Did any of that, even on the circumstances for y'all, did that strike you as having gone too far as Starfleet officers? Or was it back to...
Oh, yeah. But I kind of think like they were not Starfleet anymore. Yeah. Like they were still wearing the uniform because that's maybe all the clothes they had. But they were not... They were sort of their own entity at that point. They were not... thinking we are still Starfleet. That's not in their mind frame at all.
Right.
We're survivors. That's what they are. We are surviving this horrible situation. Yeah. We aren't Starfleet officers. We're not representatives of the Federation.
Yeah, it's just get back at all costs.
Yeah.
So you found it believable that they would have gone that far, basically given what they've gone through?
The thing that I found a little disappointing was that Marla didn't step forward sooner than she did.
Yeah. Yeah.
She clearly was uncomfortable with so many of the things that were happening. And it wasn't until the very end that she, I mean, I just think that maybe she could have done something sooner.
Yeah. I think it's kind of like what Charles was saying about because Chakotay even asked her, how can you do this? And she said, I basically didn't even think about the creatures. She said, he told me to modify the engines. And that's all I thought about, which
but
is
you would think,
easy.
You would think that coming back into a Starfleet framework coming onto Voyager will remind you of who you are, who you're supposed to be, who you were when you started this journey, and would have shaken you a little bit out of this pattern that you have found yourself in.
Especially when, she's alone with Chakotay.
Exactly.
Like, all right, take me to the captain. Here's what's going on.
Exactly.
Yeah, I thought that too. And I wondered about that because they were, and I thought it was, In some ways, I guess I blame Ransom, because I remember when Max was in the lounge, when he was in there eating, And Ransom comes over and says, that was after the thing you mentioned, Alan, when he asked Janeway that slick little conversation where he said, have you ever violated the Crane Directive? And she's like, oh, we bent it, but never all the way. And he, oh, yeah, me too. And then he goes to Max, like, yeah, we can't hang with these people. And then he's like, don't get too comfortable. And then even when they went on the ship, another thing, that's why it was all his responsibility. Because at that point, remember Lessing, that was the crewman, the black guy, he actually said, are you sure we should do this? And then all of a sudden Ransom goes, a warm meal and a shower. Is that all it takes? And he guilted them like they were betraying.
He did. Something. That is true. He guilted them into sticking to his path. Right. And then at the end, he's the one that breaks rank and says what we're doing is wrong. We need to join back up with Voyager. So he comes to his lesson, but he wouldn't let the other ones have their moment of you know, doubt or learning their own lesson. It's very, very interesting character arcs for all of those.
Exactly. I made a note about that, Alan. What I wrote, this one thing was when Max betrayed Rudy, the Captain Ransom, and then he called Janeway and said, Max decided to stage a little mutiny. The note I made was, what do you expect? The captain sets the tone. And your captain has already violated the Prime Directive. He's murdered. He's encouraged you to do so. He just abandoned a starship crew that did nothing but try to help him. So at that point in time, I'm thinking, I guess what you guys are saying is right. This is no longer a Starfleet clue. What Max did as a mutiny was not even surprising at that point in time. Because Ransom had set the tone for all that stuff. And you know, we talked about, like, one point they said, both Ransom and Max said something to the effect of, what's my alternative, 30 years in a brig? Well, I'm thinking, well, you know, yeah, that might be better than the alternative, although they think they're getting home. But by then, in a weird way, it's almost like when you see a movie where a criminal says, I've gone this far, I might as well see it through. It's almost like, in a weird way, you might as well make all the murders that they committed worth it, because they had no real assurance that the Voyager was going to survive after they left, because they took the field generator to specifically prevent it. For all they knew, Voyager could have been destroyed by those aliens. So, but up at that point in time, it's almost like, well, in for a penny, in for a pound, almost like in a weird way, you commit a horrible crime and then you see it to the end because you got to justify what you did in the first place. Almost like, well, if I stop now, would have been worth anything.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'd forgotten that, well, for one, that Rick Worthy was in this, who was Simon on Battlestar Galactica, and he was Imhotep on Stargate. He's a great actor. He's been in a lot of sci-fi.
Yeah.
But then also the guy who plays Bosch and was on Deadwood, he's playing Max.
Oh, he's great.
Yeah, they just have a great, you know, just great casting all around for these. You know, when this originally aired, I wouldn't have recognized any of them.
Right.
But now looking back, it's like, oh my gosh, look who all's in this.
And, you know, I think that makes a difference because, like I said, some people may not know, but John Savage is really, especially back in the day, John Savage was considered a very good actor in Deer Hunter, one of the great movies. And as you said, the guy who played Max, you can tell there's an elevation of the quality in this show, not just the directing, but I was looking at the directing and camera angles, but you're right. When they spoke, like when they had those conferences, when it was Janeway and Chakotay and Rudy and Max and Seven, it was like a cut above normal. There was really good acting going on in that episode. So I believed everybody on this show. I believed.
Like those guys could have been the cast of a Star Trek series. Like they were just.
Yeah.
Really good actors that, you know, in another universe could have been the leads.
Right.
And saying that, one of the things that I came out of rewatching this with is first season Discovery. Mm-hmm. When we had Lorca, we had all these occasions in past Star Treks of the rogue captain or the rogue admiral.
Yes.
And you only ever see them for one story. You see them in the episode where they get uncovered and they get brought to justice or whatever, but you never get to see the path that led them to that.
Right.
And I was so hoping that Lorca was that he wasn't a mirror Lorca or whatever, that he was actually this sort of representation of the rogue captain.
Absolutely.
And we're actually getting to see the journey that leads him to that point. And then of course they're like, I'm from the mirror universe. And I was like, oh, damn. But I would love to see, and I think it would be a real challenge. It would also be a real it would be an interesting thing to do to see like a series based on this kind of crew, one that's separated, one that's lost, one that's desperate, and see the choices that they make and why they make them.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and like you say with Lorca, and I think I made a comment to Veronica at the time, it's like you're following Matt Decker, you know, right, who's traumatized exactly. and shouldn't be in command, but trying to hold it together week after week. And exactly. I remember when, like, from the first episode, fans were saying, oh, he's evil. He must be from the Mirror Universe. And I was like, that's stupid. They're not going to do that. But then, you know, he sort of started twirling his mustache, got kicked into a black hole or something. And they sort of gave up on that. But up through the episode Lethe of Discovery, I thought he was a really fascinating character. And I think bringing it back to Equinox, it would be really interesting to follow a character like Ransom. You know, the journey that he describes in just a few minutes of, we started off as explorers and then, you know, pretty soon we forgot why we were out here. And then we forgot we were even human. You know, it would be interesting to watch that journey.
Yeah. I agree, because I'd like to know, because when he said what he said, it's clear that they have done things other than just kill these aliens. But to your point, he said their first week in the Delta Quadrant, he lost half his crew.
Yeah, I know. Just
like that.
Yeah, right? Exactly. We never recovered from that loss.
Exactly. Right. And when they went to that planet where they discovered the aliens, he said they were pretty much out of warp. They were out of dilithium, so they couldn't even go back into warp for any period of time. And you're right, I would like to see what they've been doing. And I wasn't sure how long were they in the Delta Quadrant. They didn't say specifically.
It seemed like it was around the same amount of time, because they're talking about the caretaker brought them as well.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and the caretaker's dead. Is the caretaker dead yet?
The caretaker was dead, but then there was the caretaker's mate, and I don't remember what happened with the caretaker's mate. So I don't know if it was the same caretaker or if it was just a caretaker. But I think the whole point was that they were mirroring Voyager's journey. They were, you know, instead of meeting the Borg, they met these other species and that sort of thing. But sort of a dark version of Voyager's journey.
You know what I wrote down in my notes? Because, you know, like I said, it's really easy for me to sit here in a house watching this on the internet on a couch while I'm eating to say I'd never do that, because we don't know where we'll... The truth is, any of us is capable of any atrocity. That's just truth. I don't truly believe in quote unquote being born evil. I think any of us going far enough can do horrible things. But the note I took when I was watching the show was that old saying, there for the grace of God, go I? Because what if Voyager had lost half their crew in the first week? And what if Jane had died and Chakotay had taken over, still a Maquis? What if nobody ever knew Seska was who she was, and she and B'Elanna had taken over Voyager?
Right.
They had lost half the crew. What would they have been like after 5 years? And if the Kazon were more than, in my opinion, kind of a joke, what would Voyager?
How could they have been more of a joke?
Yeah, good point, man. I know, right?
You know, man, that was the worst alien to launch a series with.
Yes. And actually, and then you look at somebody, you'd say, well, who would be their moral center? Because as we've seen so many times, Vulcan logic is not the same as human morality.
Absolutely not.
So Tuvok could have changed too. You know, he could have started doing the logic of the situation.
That's right.
Yeah.
So the moral center would have become Kes.
Well, yeah, I guess that's true. Yeah. May have.
For the first three seasons.
I'm sorry if I'm rambling. I have a question I took a note on that I wonder what did y'all think about. There was a scene, this has some of the most powerful, as you guys are saying, some of the most powerful Janeway Chakotay interactions I've ever seen.
Absolutely.
Chakotay, as you were saying, Alan, is to me one of the most criminally underused characters in all of Star Trek. I think that he had a danger to him. He still had that Maquis in him. And you're right. In this show, you saw that fierceness and that strength that Chakotay had that was never used. But there was a scene where he was telling Janeway, in almost a role reversal, to back off. And he says, you're known to hold a grudge. And she said, they disrespected that uniform. They disrespected basically their vows of Starfleet. And I always wonder if this could have gone on a little longer. I found that interesting because she's telling a former Maquis who also betrayed his uniform. And these people need to be brought to justice because they betrayed their uniform. And I wondered, as I saw even like the security guards who was arresting Ransom and his crew, one of the notes I had was, how many of these people are former Maquis who are now enforcing Federation prime directives and Janeway's rules, which are Federation rules, who themselves had violated all those rules when Janeway chased them down years ago?
Right. You assume that by the point that this episode is taking place, that they're all pretty well integrated. Mm-hmm. The problem is that the sort of divide between Starfleet mentality and Maquis mentality should have carried more through the first two seasons than it actually did.
Right.
There should have been much more development of that situation than just the first basically episode or two. And then the one episode later on where Tuvok is trying to train the, you know, the four, whoever they were, I don't even know.
But oh, yeah.
I just feel like that was such a prominent part of the setup.
Mm-hmm.
And then nothing was done with it.
Exactly. Yeah.
And to the point where you forget that some of the people that you're seeing as background characters in some of these scenes may have been Maquis.
Yeah, that's something I didn't even think about the Maquis watching this episode, aside from when they, you know, he mentioned it with BLT. But you would think there'd be a portion of the crew who'd be like, no, that's a great idea. How many weeks would it take? We're on your side.
Absolutely. Exactly. And I agreed. Wish it could have been longer. Yeah, if this could
have agreed, there's... It was just like Seska early on, before she was revealed to be who she was,
right.
Kept saying she kept being sort of like contentious about, you know, Janeway sticking to the rules and not getting the crew home.
Exactly.
Why? There's got to be people on that boat who are like, we're tired of being on this damn boat.
Exactly. Yeah.
We have got to get home somehow.
I agree with you. And I think,
and we can still say we're Starfleet, but we have got to figure out some way to get home.
Yeah. Cause sometimes even in that one episode where the hologram, basically a role-playing game that Seska had left behind, remember the game that Tuvok had programmed, they found out where it was a simulated mutiny where the Maquis took over the ship. And in that game or when that simulation, when Chakotay took over, to your point, Alan, and when he took over, he gathered the crew and he says, we're not going to stop and explore every single anomaly. Because sometimes even I think, you know, I love the show. Sometimes they'll go, oh, hey, there's a really cool quasar nearby. You want to stop and go look? And even Chakotay sometimes will go, that's why we're here. Like, dude.
I know. I mean, you can find quasars in the Alpha Quadrant.
Exactly.
If you find something that's completely unique that you would never have seen before, then maybe stop and do some, you know, scans or whatever. But get the people home.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I think that was kind of the point of it. But I think, I wish it could have been a three-part. I do think there was a missed opportunity to have even a few conversations, even if Chakotay and B'Elanna, because, you know, sometimes you would remember that they're really close to each other. Even Chakotay and B'Elanna had privately had a conversation and saying, you know, this was us not too long ago. We violated the uniform. We, we cut corners or, you know, we cut moral corners. And I can see them going, this could have been us.
That's a great point, Keith.
Yeah.
That is a really good point. I do wish that they had inserted some, it could have been 90 seconds, but just some little conversation that acknowledged that point.
Right.
That would have been great.
Yeah, I think so too. I'm sorry, we can close the time. I know I'm talking. I have one quick question for all of y'all. There was one thing that kept coming up, and I know what the answer should be and what Roddenberry would say. Several times in this show and several times in the series, they have said something to the effect of, even Chakotay says, we're no longer in the Alpha Quadrant. We're no longer in Federation space. Perhaps the Prime Directive doesn't apply. Is there ever a time where a statement that the rules, and not just the regulations of a military, but the morals in which you were raised, that you say it doesn't apply because I'm no longer where I used to be? Is that ever justified?
I think if you have the full expectation of getting home, then yes. If you have, and I don't know why, but if you have given up hope, if you have resigned yourself to, I will never get home, then maybe. I don't know. That's kind of the line that I see there. I don't know if that's right.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the justification point that you might come to in your own mind.
Right.
I think for Janeway, she was 100% determined and convinced that they were going to get home. So in that mindset, we have to remain Starfleet.
Yeah.
we have to uphold our principles.
It was a recurring theme on the original series that they were out on the frontier. They're out of contact, out of contact. Kirk can't call for help. It's really down to him to interpret these situations and make the decision. And Janeway's in a similar situation. Now, I think that Ransom made a good point when she started quoting the regulations as far as who's in command. Now, I guess you got to have somebody in command, but he made the point that, yeah, I don't know if that regulation applies here. You know, if there's just us.
Yeah, you know? Exactly.
On the one hand, you know, they need to take their training, the morality, the values that they stand for and interpret that. But when it comes down to the rules and regulations, I think there should be some wiggle room when you're, you know, you may never make it home. You know, you're 70 years away from home. To have some wiggle room of like, okay, well, let's sit down and talk about this. Don't just quote regulations at me.
Right. And I think the other side of it is that even without getting home, they still always hoped to find some way of establishing contact with the Federation. And I think that maybe before and after the episode Pathfinder, this might be a different answer. But because after Pathfinder, after you've been in contact with the Federation, but, you know, even before then, you want to be able, like the first thing that Janeway did when Pathfinder contacted them is we're downloading all of our logs, all of our, you know, everything.
Right.
You want to be able to do that and have a clean record as clean as possible.
Yeah.
You know, and so, you know, I think that I guess it's just the circumstances you find yourself in.
Yeah, I was pretty much leaning towards what Chuck was saying of yeah, let's keep our basic core values, but let's follow the intent of what the rule is supposed to be as opposed to the law of what it's supposed to be.
Or, yeah,
you know, it's funny because I and I'm by no means I don't believe in strict moral laws and rules. Like I was raised in a church, but my dad was a preacher, but I don't believe in like throwing morality at people. I don't even use the word morality and sin very much in my personal life, if I can avoid it, because those words are just loaded. But it was funny watching this show. I understood Ransom, but I kept just feeling that I got Janeway better. I was like when Ransom said we're in the Alpha Quadrant, we're no longer in the Alpha Quadrant, I don't think maybe the Prime Directive doesn't apply, maybe the rules don't apply. I feel they have to apply, because it's not the laws that you're supposed to obey, it's the principles that you're supposed to obey. And I kind of feel that no matter how far away you are from home, you carry that inside of you. And if you stop obeying those laws, whether no one around you does, and whether you're thousands of light years from home, you stop being human. And then it's almost to me, and this is so easy again for me to say in a warm house, I would rather think I'm the person who would die for my principles than live for anything. And I would like to think I'd be more like Janeway and never break, which probably means in real life, I'd probably kill people and become a pirate because I'm saying such a moralistic, savvy thing.
Well, and here's the thing. Of course, you want your audience to identify with Janeway.
Yeah.
You know, but the thing, what makes a really well-written story is that the good guys and the bad guys are both relatable.
Absolutely.
That you understand why the bad guys are the bad guys.
Absolutely.
That they have motives that make sense, that you can understand the situations that they've been put in and why they make the choices that they make. Mm-hmm. You may not agree with them. You may think, if I were in that situation, I'd do something different. But you understand why they did it. And that's what makes great writing. And I think that's the hallmark of this two-parter, is that it really draws both sides in a completely relatable and understandable way.
Absolutely. Well said.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah. And unless anyone has any closing thoughts, I think that's a good place to leave it with Equinox.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
Yeah. It was a really good one. I'm sorry to do this. I had one little quick thought. It's something which you said, Alan, was Janeway, her reaction. It's, at the end, when Ransom found himself, the crew was dubious at first, and Ransom was trying to help them. And then when he sacrificed himself, Janeway had this look on her face. She said he was a Starfleet captain, and he forgot that for a while. And it's, you see that with Kirk and with Spock, with Kirk and with Picard and with Sisko and Archer. and all these people, you see that being a captain, it puts a special burden on you that separates them even from other people. And it seems to me that one of the things was what you said, Janeway saw an image of what she could have become. And I think that horrified her, mm-hmm. also personally offended her and insulted her. It was like, how dare you do this to what we are? We're supposed to be better than that. But I think it also frightened her as well. And I think that was kind of the lesson here of what she said was, nobody's perfect. And it was a complicated situation. And at the end of the day, you sometimes do the best you can. And sometimes you make horrible mistakes. But I guess that's what makes us human.
Mm. All right. Well, if people want to hear more of what you think about this episode, Alan, where can they find you on the internet?
The best place to find me is my publishing company, Cosmic Press, K-O-Z-M-I-C Press. You can find me on Facebook, Twitter, and my website, cosmicpress.com.
How about you, Keith?
You can find me on Facebook. I'm in all the ESO network groups posting, and also on Instagram. I have a Twitter account, but I don't use it very much. So mostly Facebook is best for me.
And Veronica, what about us?
You can find us at feltnerdy.com.
Yep, we're also active on the Earth Station Trek Facebook group. So if anyone has any comments or corrections for this episode, log on there and let us know, and we'll address them.
Thank you for listening to Earth Station Trek. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. Give us a positive rating. You can also send us feedback at earthstationtrek@gmail.com. You can join in the fun in our Facebook group or follow us on Twitter. You can also visit us online at earthstationtrek.podbean.com. We'll see you next time. Live long and prosper.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.